Hi, everyone. Oh, I see a hand back there waving. Hello. I love a good hand wave. Oh, yeah. What a packed house. We have several people on our Zoom, my phone over here set up, but then we also have such a large audience in here tonight. So that's very exciting. I just want to welcome all of you, whether you're here with us in person or if you're here on the Zoom, to week two of the Hemingway Summer Poetry Series. Let's give everyone a round of applause. Tonight, we're featuring writers and editors, Kelly Andrews, Margaret Bashar, Timmons, Isaias, thank you. I know I was about to stumble. I appreciate you. Mike Good and Gwendolyn Mitchell. And Hemingway's will take place in person at White Whale all summer. And we can't wait to see you at our future meetings. So just a little bit about myself and White Whale quickly. I'm Halsey, the events coordinator here at White Whale Bookstore. White Whale Bookstore is a family-owned general interest independent store located in the Bloomfield neighborhood of Pittsburgh. Our store motto is conversation, community, and culture, and we strive to be a home for book lovers. So just a few events coming up that we think you might be interested in. On Friday, May 26th at 7 p.m., we're excited to celebrate a new anthology from UGA Press, The Long Devotion, Poets Writing Motherhood. And we'll be joined online by contributor Zena Hashenbeck, Joy Katz, and Emily Moan Slate, as well as editors Emily Perez and Nancy Reddy. So don't miss out on that reading and conversation. Then on Tuesday, May 24th at 7 p.m., we are thrilled to virtually host William Brewer in celebration of his latest book, The Red Arrow. And William will be in conversation with Mima Abashia, author of Another Appalachia, Growing Up Queer and Indian in a Mountain Place. And some of you might have been at that launch. She recently just read in the store with Gita Kathari. So you might have been there. It was fabulous. I didn't get to be here myself, but it's a really great book. And then we do ask that you keep your masks on at all times. The authors and myself will be removing our masks whenever we talk at the mic, but if you could just keep them on whenever you are just moving around and while you're seated, that would be absolutely perfect. And I just wanna bring your attention, the restrooms are behind me. So if you need to use them, I do encourage you to go ahead and use them now. Thank you also for pointing that way. If you do have to use the restroom during the reading, of course, that's fine. I won't be mad at you, listen to your body. but I do encourage you if you need to do so now. So just be sure, I'm gonna be locking the door in the back here in a moment whenever I turn things over to Chris, but you won't be locked in here. that's just so that people aren't coming in during the reading on this side, and then people can have their vax cards checked on the opposite side. And then I believe, oh yeah, and you're also so welcome to hang out at the end of the night and buy books. We do have Gwendolyn and Margaret's books over here. And Margaret is doing a combo deal. So if you buy both of them, you can buy them for $10. So, you know, totally worth it. But please go ahead and support those authors as well as check out anything in the store. I'm always happy to give recommendations. And I believe that that is it from me. I'm going to turn things over to nobody other than Christopher Collin.
So much. What? Is there already heckling? Oh, right. That's why we always want Margaret at these events. What? What? Yeah, you do. Yeah, you know exactly what I'm talking about. All right, Halsey is locking us in. So if you want out of this bookshop tonight, you better show some goddamn appreciation. welcome to Hemingway's. Gonna read a quick little thing here. And I'm gonna say some shit. Dawn is coming up in San Francisco now, 6:09 a.m. I can hear the rumble of early morning buses under my window at the Seal Rock Inn. Out here at the far end of Geary Street, this is the end of the line for buses and everything else. The western edge of America. From my desk, I can see the dark, jagged hump of seal rock looming out of the ocean in the gray morning light. About 200 seals have been barking out there most of the night. Staying in this place with the windows open is like living next to a dog pound. Last night, we had a huge paranoid poodle up here in the room, and the dumb bastard went totally out of control when the seals started barking. Racing around the room like a chicken hearing a pack of wolves outside the window, howling and whining, leaping up on the bed and scattering my book galley pages all over the floor, knocking the phone off the hook, upsetting the gin bottles, trashing my carefully organized stacks of campaign photographs. Off to the right of this typewriter on the floor between the beds, I can see an 8x10 print of Frank Mankiewicz yelling into a telephone at the Democratic Convention in Miami. But that will never be used because the goddamn hound put 5 big claw holes in the middle of Frank's chest. That dog will not enter this room again. He came in with the book editor, who went away about six hours ago with 13 finished chapters, the bloody product of 55 consecutive hours of sleepless, foodless, high-speed editing. But there was no other way to get the thing done. I am not an easy person to work with in terms of deadlines. When I arrived in San Francisco to put this book together, they had a work hole set up for me downtown in the Rolling Stone office. But I have a powerful aversion to working in offices. And when I didn't show up for 3 or 4 days, they decided to do the logical thing, move the offices out here to the Seal Rock Inn. One afternoon, about 3 days ago, they showed up at my door with no warning and loaded about 40 pounds of supplies into the room. 2 cases of Mexican beer, 4 quarts of gin, 12 grapefruits, and enough speed to alter the outcome of 6 Super Bowls. There was also a big Selectric typewriter, 2 reams of paper, a face cord of oak, firewood, and 3 tape recorders, just in case the situation got so desperate that I might finally have to resort to verbal composition. We came to this point sometime around the 33rd hour when I developed an insoluble writer's block and began dictating big chunks of the book straight into the microphone, pacing around the room at the end of an 18-foot cord and saying anything that came into my head. When we reached the end of a tape, the editor would jerk it out of the machine and drop it into the satchel. And every 12 hours or so, a messenger would stop by to pick up the tape satchel and take it downtown to the office, where unknown persons transcribed it onto manuscript paper and sent it straight to the printer in Reno. There is a comfortable consistency in this kind of finish, because that's the way all the rest of the book was written. From December 1971 to January of 73, in airport bars, online coffee shops, and dreary hotel rooms all over the country, there is hardly a paragraph in this jangled saga that wasn't produced in a last-minute, teeth-grinding frenzy. There was never enough time. Every deadline was a crisis. So that's Hunter S. Thompson, Fear and Loathing on the Campaign Trail, which is all to say, working with writers is very difficult thing to do. And our readers tonight, in one way or another, whether as editors, publishers, workshop leaders, advocates, have all worked with writers to promote their work, to see that work across the finish line, to be the conduit that travels from the writer to the reader, because that nowadays, that can happen, but most often it doesn't. It requires intermediaries who just believe in the work, who love it, who love the writers, who love the poetry, who love the prose, and just, they just fucking want it in other people's hands so that they can have the feeling that they have when they read it the first time. And tonight, Joan and I really, as I said this last week, last 2 weeks, 2 weeks ago. This was one of the readings we had proposed prior to the pandemic hitting. We really wanted to celebrate writers in town who set aside their own work, their own time, their own lives to work as advocates for the work of other writers in Pittsburgh and elsewhere. It is an often thankless job. Not always dependent on hellhounds and cocaine, but often, more often than you think. Margaret will be up here. She'll tell you about ghosts too, right? What? Oh, you'll know it. But yeah, we really wanted to celebrate the folks who, when you work as an editor, you are, as a writer, and you decide to work as an editor, you are really setting aside your own work, you know, to spend time in another person's world and to make that world a reality for as many readers as you can. And that's a very special thing that is often left, unsung, unpraised. And tonight, we applaud everyone who's going to be at this mic for not only being fantastic writers and great members of our local literary community, but also advocates and editors and people who have done an incredible amount of work in just making literature real for writers like the rest of us, or just readers, even if you don't write on your own. It's a beautiful thing, and I've worked on both sides of that line. I appreciate all of you tonight, and I know Joan does as well. So thank you. Thank you for your service. So now that I've invoked Joan's name, Joan will come and say something. It's not like Bloody Mary or anything. You don't have to say it. Beetlejuice. Say it three times. Say it all together. Joan Bauer, Joan Bauer, Joan Bauer. And Joan will arrive. Thank you.
Let's see, is that working?
Yeah.
Well, I'm really thrilled to be here. And I'm always especially thrilled when Chris does the introduction because it's so wonderful. And he had he's had a busy couple of weeks. And I think we should just say a big yay and happy days and wonderful good wishes to Chris and his wife Anna, because Anna gave birth to yet another amazing Collins baby. And this one is named Joni Mitchell Ruth Collins, and she arrived on Mother's Day. Anna, if you get a chance to hear this, if you're not too busy, we applaud you. Yay! So there was a lot of poetry and literature over the weekend. It was great to see the Pittsburgh Book Festival do its debut, a really interesting rollout. And I hope some of you were there and some of us were there. But tonight, we are here at White Whale, and we're really grateful to be here. This is a wonderful home for this series, and it is thrilling to be able to be in this wonderful space with all the folks at White Whale who are so great and generous with us, and these amazing books, and all of you. So we'll just get started, and we are going to go in alphabetical order, and these are five poets, editors, whom we were so happy we had this in mind for 2 years ago. We're so happy they could be here tonight. So first up is Kelly Lorraine Andrews, whose poems have appeared in Dream Pop Journal, Ghost Proposal, Ninth Letter, and among others. She's the author of five chapbooks, including Sonnets in Which the Speaker is on Display, My poem, my body is a poem. I can't stop writing. She has an MFA from University of Pittsburgh in poetry. And along with her husband and two cats, she tends to her garden and tries to be tender to herself too. Please welcome Kelly Lorraine Andrews.
Let's see if I can. How is that? Y'all hear me? Yeah. Great.
Thank you, Bowden, for being here. It's really wild to be back in front of a microphone and reading poems, and I'm very, very thrilled to be here. I'm going to jump right in. I just have like maybe, I don't know how many poems, but not that many. So I'll go ahead and start. The Madonna of the Rabbit. One. The baby bunny's back again, chewing grass with ears turning and turning. Rabbits were thought to reproduce without touch, their white fur pure as the mother. When my husband hoses the garden, it darts and hides behind a shovel, femoral artery pulsing as it counts the seconds. Attentiveness is the natural prayer of the soul, said some French philosopher. I watch its little heart beat, 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 beat. Two. I follow you with my spiritual name, braid your voice into my own. Children chatter outside the frame. In memory, the sun sits at a 60-degree angle to Earth. We're prettily reflecting and scattering the wavelengths. When I called on the dream line, it wasn't you really. Hair too short and a yellow blonde, but it felt good to say I'm capable of growing too. I see your black hollyhock fruitful while taking its time to be conscious. I want to be the bunny held close as you give the baby to another, to lie in the blue of you. I want to buy an expensive couch and other things I don't need. This year, a dreary highway of toddlers standing stupid. I imagine the car drifting into a pasture, a steadfast away from Earth, then rebirth. In my next life, I hope to be a cat, maybe found in a park by a bride posing next to some tall oaks. It would always be autumn in my next life. Not this year with its scorching afternoons and strict rules. I keep outgrowing my clothes, dyeing my hair a darker green. Look at my purple lipstick, my bright pink painted toes. I'm in the alley smoking a shame cigarette, watching the neighbors on their second story patio. This year, already halfway over, and just last night, my first summer blister from walking home. Sometimes I forget to thank my lungs in this disrepaired house of a body. There's always a surface that needs wiped or puffs of fur collecting in corners. The butterfly bush overgrown in the neighbor's walkway. I shaved my legs in the backyard with men's clippers. I think it's been 3 years since I last saw that varicose vein spidered on my skin. I took a vacation, but everything looked the same as when I last looked, 3 years or more. This year, I'm trying to do it all, or at least dropping my wedding ring off at the jeweler's while the hair dye fades from both hands. Even the mailman noticed how jaded I seem. All I want to do is wear white, get enlightened already. So a lot of the poems that I've been writing in the last couple years have been related to cats. So I'm just gonna read one cat poem tonight, and that is this one. It is called Becoming a Cat. Before, I thought a lot about interior design, blue hand-woven rugs, a string of hearts to hang from the dusty basement shower, an emerald velvet Chesterfield. I wanted to be pretty with things. First came the tail, and then the urge to pull down the variegated succulent, rip threads from the expense of insatiableness. I spent hours licking myself clean, a new kind of work requiring methodical attention and no less exhausting than copy editing. As I slept, changes in body hair came next. Sometimes I'd spend 10 to 12 hours under a heating blanket, perfecting my whiskers. I liked the feel of the tufted sofa under my nails. Mostly, I was tired of quieting my wildness, domesticated still, but now with sharper teeth. Okay, so I have a chapbook called My Body's Poem I Can't Stop Writing, and I never really stopped writing these poems with that title. There's a bunch in the chapbook that have that title. But it's also kind of like a nice way of like, if I write a poem, a body poem, then I just slap that title on and I'm like, great, another body, my body's poem can't stop writing. So, yeah, it works out really well for me. Okay. My body is a poem I can't stop writing. Welcome back, Riss. I stay stuck here, unable to move on or up from anything, but especially not how my body balloons over a row of houses and out of view. Welcome back, elbows. With crossed arms, I rotate my fingers in a slow circle, and it's erotic like an exposed set of nipples I only just discovered. They're dry but ticklish. Welcome back, knees, so reliably bony. Like the wrists, like the elbows, they're solid, close to the surface. All day long, they bend and bend. Welcome back, ankles, the most redeeming quality of feet. Once I slipped slowly out of a tree and everything concentrated down. All that pressure, but I'm no mathematician. I wore a boot like a stump. I swung my leg wide and tried not to shower. Welcome back, thighs. It's hard being gentle. I practiced spreading my fingers wide to accommodate the extra flesh, but my hands went to squeeze, pinch, pull. I say again, welcome back, thighs, and pretend to stroke an invisible cat. Welcome back, belly, my babyless bump. For now, I'll aim for neutrality. No jokes about bearing burritos, just a hello. Welcome back, ass that never left, my one true blessing. Okay, and then this will be my last poem. Thank you to everybody for being such a great audience and for being here. And Joan and Chris for inviting me. I don't want to be an adult. I want to be a child, I say. After months of filling out retirement paperwork, notarizing and scanning, only for it to be rejected because I didn't sign in ink. My mother can't help me. My sisters can't help me. I'm a tall, fat baby preparing for a future like it might come someday. Like I might need to live a long time in this dumb body, navigating bank accounts and property taxes. I hate, hate, hate responsibility and capability and the drive to plan. Give me a red plastic swing attached to an apple tree. Give me Barbies who cook plastic hot dogs on a plastic grill. Give me a bathtub to dunk their hair in, to talk softly to when I think no one can hear. Let me roll in the just cut grass. Let me skin an elbow on a bit of bark. Let me roller skate at Papa Wheelie's roller rink, unafraid of what bone I might break. I'm so tired of showing up to work, running the sweeper, combing my hair. Someone make me a child again. I'll learn how to do a cartwheel. I'll spend hours staring at the sky. I'll try to remember the feeling. I promise to enjoy it this time. Thank you.
Wow, thank you so much. Gee. Next up is Margaret Bashar, the author of Stationed Near the Gateway from Sundress Publications. She's the author of also numerous chapbooks. She's the founding editor of Hyacinth Girl Press and co-founder of the occasional anarchist poetry event, Free Poems. Please welcome Margaret Bashar.
Like to taste at Free Poems. That made me happy. Thank you. Now I'm going to adjust the mic. Okay, there. Is that good? We good? Yes. All right, thumbs up, yay. All right. So I haven't done a poetry reading in a million years, so sorry. / you're welcome. So most of the poems I write are in some way about ghosts. I read a whole book that's largely about ghosts, so I'm going to read a poem from that. Because she does not know what is at the back of her head. Mary says she will know when her mouth is full and the water boils over. filled with honey and apple seeds, she will become all at once the senses she never knew. She writes notes in black ink on the pads of her fingers, presses them onto library books or handles of coffee shop mugs. Mouth open like the sun, pockets stuffed with cattails, her eyes are widened to the letters on her fingers, pinhead bruises on her thighs. She feels voices like an undertow, and there is a hand that uncurls inside her like a fern, stretches and cracks, reaches into her throat. And I wrote a little chapbook with a friend of mine who lives in California. And they're all poems that are based off of, I'm going to read some of them up, if I don't get it wrong, The Ladder of Divine Ascent, which is a monastic text from the 7th century about attempting to reach spiritual enlightenment. And she and I wrote these together, so it's kind of a mix of the two of us. When you peel back the hangnail, when you dislodge the arrowhead from your skin, notice how your teeth grit, how your pinked flesh hums in that moment before the blood comes. You have always known what you would do if the house caught fire, if the glass shattered. You have always known the shape of a man's mouth when he lies, how hot your neighbor's breath. This is not the final straw. This is not the step ball change you thought it was. When you carry the logs, they split and splinter. When you carry the logs up the stairs, soil crumbles. When you carry, you are cumbersome. What you cannot love, it cannot love you. But the fire will scrub you joyful, mark your third eye with indifferent ash. When the rat scurries across the floor, when birds explode from the bonfire, do not move. When your legs are tied in a pretty bow, do not cut them off. Do not follow the line to make them straight. When your head begins to tilt, your eyes cross, my dear, uncurl your back. The night is not always for sleeping. God is counting your prayers. He stacks them in a file like a clerk. When the klaxon wails, he already knows who you will save, the difference between your first phone call and the one you want to make. So peel your body back, the need for it. Keep your eyes open and get well. If I tell you enough times I am not hungry, someday I will be the one who believes it. So there's kind of only poems I write anymore about cannibals. So I'm gonna read some of those. This Cannibal Island Tourism. It's about like an island the cannibals live on. You guys don't know. Whole thing. Cannibals on island. Good luck. Cannibal Island is home to some very popular tourist destinations. For example, they have the largest field of unmarked graves in the world. Cannibal Island also has some great coffee shop bar combos, because if there are two things cannibals love, other than the taste of human flesh, it's caffeine and liquor. Cannibal Island also has some delightfully lax open container laws, so you may sip bourbon from a to-go cup as you stroll through the field of unmarked graves. The Cannibal Island Tourism Board would like to assure you that doing so will make you look remarkably cool / disaffected on Instagram. And we all know that is what's really important here. Sometimes the cannibals lie. They tell the non-cannibals who live on Cannibal Island that all other islands are full of James Francos. In reality, there's only one James Franco, and he has a summer home on Cannibal Island. They tell the non-cannibals who live on Cannibal Island they are trying to change Cannibal Island from the inside. They tell the non-cannibals that they are very concerned about the high numbers of straight white male cannibals on Cannibal Island. They open their mouths. It's all teeth, 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 teeth. If we're being honest, cannibals are pretty bad with numbers. A lot of non-cannibals move to Cannibal Island thinking that cannibalism is a lucrative business, but it is not. No one who is not a cannibal really cares about cannibalism all that much these days. Every so often, there will be a movie in which a cannibal is depicted poorly, but that about covers cannibalism in popular culture anymore. Sometimes the cannibals like to say that cannibalism is not a popular topic for movies and television because cannibals and the cannibal lifestyle are just too real. But deep down, everyone knows that it is not because the cannibals are just too real. Cannibal Island would be beautiful were it not for all these cannibals. Imagine the sun, but it is a heart. And the top of the heart has been cut away. The heart is still beating and blood pumps out in bursts. The other half of the heart is in the mouth of a man. His mouth is so large he could swallow the whole heart, but he has taken only half into his mouth. He bites down and the half of a heart in his mouth bends and molds in his jaws. And he might be drowning in the blood now, or he might be pulling a black veil over his face, but either way he is gone. Two more cannibals. Not the title, it's just how many poems I've left. You have to know the worth of your flesh, the labor it performs. There is cash value for your bones, no part of the body unuseful. But if you are a non-cannibal, you may not know this. You might be happy just to have a house. You might be happy because you can see in front of you cupped hands filled with blood, but you cannot reach the hands or the blood. And you would not know what to do with them anyway. This is my last poem. This is Cannibal Island Dream Sequence. Sometimes a cannibal wakes up to find they are a non-cannibal who nodded off at their desk. The non-cannibal wakes up to find they are a cannibal who went to bed with high blood pressure at a CPAP machine. The cannibal with high blood pressure and a CPAP wakes up to find they are the bones of a victim of cannibalism, attempting to discover empathy for their devourer. The bones of the victim of cannibalism wake up to find they are a 15-year-old girl from Ohio who tried to watch Cannibal Holocaust when her parents went out for the evening. The 15-year-old girl from Ohio wakes up to find she is a painter with weak hearing who sometimes sees visions of mutilated bodies when she closes her eyes, and sometimes when she does not close her eyes. The painter with weak hearing wakes up to find she is a deep, dark pit that has developed consciousness and awareness, but there is nothing to be aware of. They all, one by one, go back to sleep. Thank you.
Really good microphone. It works.
I'm
have to fight with it. No. Well, it's great to see so many here, people here tonight. This month.
Yay.
Tim and Zayas, and I have actually known each other for a long time, like 22 years probably. Yeah, because we're both members of a workshop. And so I have had the great pleasure of having him find unbelievably stupid errors in my poems for 22 years. And I can count on him to do that. When 10 people have read the poem and everybody, hey, looks good to me. And, you know, take it to workshop with Tim and he will say, well, you might consider explain the real meaning of a word that I didn't know. Tim Isaias is a satirist, writer, and poet living in Pittsburgh. His works range from literary to genre, have been published in 22 languages. He has also been the finalist for the British Science Fiction Award, twice won the Asimov Readers Award. His story, Norbert and the System, appears in a textbook and a college curriculum. He was shortlisted for the 2019 Gregory O'Donohue International Poetry Prize, and his wonderful full-length Lewis Award-winning collection, Poetry why elephants no longer communicate in Greek, we can't even find a copy of it. They're all sold out, I think, aren't they?
I have a few.
He has a few. It is wonderful. It is, and that was brought out by Concrete Press, Concrete Wolf a while back. We're for a special treat. Please welcome Tim Azaias.
I'm not so sure how special the treat will be. I've been in prison in my room for 2 years because my wife is a doctor and I'm a danger to the public. Thanks to everybody who made this possible. Thanks to the lovely blue whale back there. That inspires me. I've been stuck in my room. I wrote a story with a pillow as the protagonist. I wrote a story about what happens to all the Concord grape jelly packets that we don't eat and throw away when they come from the landfills for revenge. And I wrote several of these poems, literary frame poems, front and back, stuck in my room for 2 years, imagination poems in the middle, mostly science fiction-y. The first one is actually autobiographical. In the period right after 9/11, I did a job for the CIA, or as they called it, the funding agency. And the reason I did it was so that for the rest of my life, I could say, yeah, well, when I worked for CIA, we didn't do it that way. But this is not an autobiographical poem about that, entitled The Terror. He is a writer, they said, understands interrelationships, how things fit together. So now I type lists of the dead, lists of the killers into computable rows, that the dots may be connected, so that things may be fitted together. Boole invented a syntax just for this. I list why the dead are dead and who paid to make them so. There is an economy of death, foundations that make grants, committees that meet, a lot, analyze. The committees are well paid, but thrive on herds of volunteers. I type all this as if it could compute. I think this may explain itself. Formal petition to switch universes. Oh, black holes, oh, missing matter, oh, third and fourth laws of thermodynamics, hear my petition, my plea, and prayer. When I was born, there were no wolves in Wales. Humans are still subject to wars, to wasting disease, to junior high school. Oh, powers, get me out of here. Accept my petition to be reborn in a Welsh Republic, the center of a Gymri empire. No war, no disease, no Starbucks, no time bonus on chess clocks, no designated hitter. Oh, powers, that universe, surely it's out there. And no golf. No gulf of days present, no gulf of times past, no gulf of ages yet to come. Oh, powers, take me there. Why we kill planets. As a rule, we do not mean to kill them. But if they are unseemly, that must be corrected. If they are pure ice balls, that must be corrected. If they lack character, it must be instilled. If they lack purpose, one will be provided for them. This is not always without risk. If a planet is insane, what is to be done? An insane planet in a straitjacket is now more massive than it was and still insane. Lithium triggers fires. Thunderbolts and lightning have proven ineffective as a treatment. I hear the water running, Pavlov's dog. A photograph of Pavlov's dogs is in our house on the second floor. It's a photograph of Pavlov's dogs, the laboratory staff, and Pavlov himself on a picnic. So this one I sold to Asimov's just like last week. So it should be out end of the year, early next year. It's entitled The Next Step, and it's a success story. The successful barnacle will be The successful barnacle will be a self-starter, perfectly willing to relocate. The successful barnacle will not be looking for a handout. It will only be seeking a reliable outflow. The successful barnacle will learn to eat plastic and like it. The successful barnacle will understand that animals are just mobile sacks of seawater. It will act on that knowledge. The successful barnacle will not tolerate the world's fresh water for long. The successful barnacle will coat the continents and learn to filter the air. The successful barnacle will not listen to excuses. It will not listen at all. The successful barnacle will take the view that just because a thing has been around for a long time does not make it necessary. So this is my Bukowski derivative rant on gravity. I taught the writing of science fiction to undergraduates at Seton Hall, and I decided the best way to start was to shake their world in a hooky kind of way. So I asked, show of hands, how many of you believe in gravity? And all the hands went up. And I said, oh, you poor things. This is entitled, Face It. You try to learn something, logged on or TFNV, and these science twits are all gravity this and gravity that. When Zoroaster on toast, folks, we've known these 100 years and more, ain't no such thing. But we tell it to the kids, tell it to the Marines, hang on to the lie, the old fraud, make excuses about terminology. And it's past time to let them lame-ass their way around it. So no, she is not attracted to you. She is following her own path, and you are just in her way. And no, there is no force holding you down. It's your own fault. Einstein, for chaos' sake, 1915. The company H&B that I mentioned in the first line makes professional baseball bats. This is entitled Louisville Scriveners. I wish the Hillerich and Bradsby Company made pens. Wish you could go down to the factory, see the model Melville used to create Moby Dick. Note how the condor quill is hafted to English oak, built to handle both adjectives and metaphor. Or the hefty birch staff Solzhenitsyn used in exile. The firm iron pen Steinbeck deployed to press the grapes of wrath. Poe's wicked device, neither crow feather nor raven, but a hawthorn stylus tipped with obsidian. Then you could have them make one for you, just like your heroes, or something new. Experts will tell you it's not the pen that makes the writer, but we all know both the hand and the tool are behind the mystery. Shaking, I've done this for a while. Ending as I started with an autobiographical poem based on the belief that you are what you read, especially what you read and remember. It's entitled Confessional Poem. I am the crystal egg, and I am the urn from the coast. I am also, it is true, any friend of Nicholas Nickleby's is a friend of mine, and there will come soft rains. Thanks to my most important teacher, let us name her Peggy Usher. I sometimes ask, are there no prisons? Are there no workhouses when the subjects of child care or elder care come up? But I am one who would, I hope, walk away from Omelas. I am Sir and Direction of the Road, and be warned, the day before the revolution. Being Welsh in background, I am chivalry, but I'm also Borges and I, and the Red-Headed League, and possibly Jekyll, but more probably Hyde. I am the lost years and am the chief operator, but try not to be in the penal colony or good country people. I find myself wondering about the Dowager Duchess of Medway, about her past. Strangers ask if I am really the sweetheart of the Song Chabon or the darkness behind it. I am both, I tell them, both. To my great surprise, I am the selfish giant. But the truth, the bottom line, is that being a friend of Nicholas Nickleby, I am the final breaking up of Do the Boys Hall. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Mike Good lives in Pittsburgh and serves as managing editor of Autumn House Press. Some of his recent poems can be found or forthcoming in Bennington Review, December 5-Point, Plowshares, Salamander, Waxwing, and others, along with anthologies such as, and this is really interesting, a Pittsburgh Neighborhood Guidebook, Bell Publishing, yay. His work has received support from the Swanee Writers Conference and The Sun, and he holds an MFA from Hollins University, and you can find more about him at well, you can talk to him tonight, but you can also find more about him at mikegoodwrites.wordpress.com. And I really enjoy hearing him read. Please welcome Mike Good.
Can everybody hear me okay? Yeah. I feel like most of the time I never adjust the mic. I just kind of crane up and down. So this is a new experience for me. Thank you for all being here with me for it. Thank you again to Joan and Chris for having me. I think probably a lot of you know the Hemingway series has been around for so long and provide a platform for so many wonderful writers. I remember, especially after I graduated from Pitt, hearing Jimmy at the open mic, hearing poets like Edo Chester for the first time, and really just like giving me hope, I think, that there was room for poetry outside the classroom that I had just left. Also, thanks again to Kelly, Margaret, Tim, and we're really excited to hear you, Gwendolyn, coming next. So sit tight, everybody. I'm gonna try to read 5 poems, depending on the time, which I should have already set, but I got nervous, so I didn't. Mm-hmm. I'm gonna set it now. I'm probably gonna forget everything and not look at it, but I'll do my best to at least hold myself accountable. If not, Joan will tackle me. So I wasn't able to attend the reading a couple weeks ago, but I really loved the theme, which was celebrating Pittsburgh poets. And so I wanted to extend that spirit and read one poem by Mary Ruffel, who was actually born in the Keysport. She's a contemporary poet. I've been having the pleasure of reading a lot of her work of late. This poem is called My Happiness. I laid my happiness in a field. My happiness lay in the field and looked up at the sky. My happiness extended the same courtesy to the clouds. My happiness in the field was visible for miles around. My happiness was visible to the hawk. My happiness was fond of the beetle beside it. A porcupine lumbered by. My happiness followed it. Perhaps because it was being followed, the porcupine stole my happiness. My happiness lumbered along after itself happily. We came to a road. The porcupine went into a culvert and didn't come out. And that was the end of my happiness. So switch over to some poems. So if you're counting down, that was poem number 1, 4 to go. The first 2 will be a little bit on the longer side. This poem is a Sestina. It's called Ode to Big Chungus, and I'm just going to go ahead and read it. Ode to Big Chungus. Oh shit, here he comes, and damn it, he is so big. The safety we cling to, it is not so big. I wish it were bigger. To live in a nation with a big time belly. How big? Not big enough. We sigh, big sighs. The belly grows oh so big. Big Chungus, bigger than all the Iliads, bigger than all the fates and furies of antiquity. His big heart races like a furious fluffle across a big field. Watching Big Chungus, our hearts grow bunny big, popping like clouds or roots pop, burrowing and growing big. And yes, and beauteous with cartoon big eyes, we look upon you. Yes, big. Big Chungus. To love as Big Chungus loves is to be big in amorous desire. When did life shrink in the biggest of ways? To hate is to be a small sort of big, not Chungus. Chungus knows big smallness creates bigger smallness. Not such big waves or novels or poems or big ideas or big politicians with their big names and retinue of big ideas and their big whoopsies. Jump high. Big whoopee. Oh, my big dreams. Oh, my once bigger designs. They could have been Chungus big. humongous chungus, sweet colossus, chungus big, you who most of all has spent life in bigness, and now here he comes, see it in his big jalopy, rolling out the bunny hole, big like the Grand Canyon is big, jello stone will erupt big, kaboom, whoa, so big, we were not a big generation, though we dreamed. We dreamed big instead of becoming. Even in love, we stunk big stinks. But here it comes, for real. Big chungus out of air to save me again, to reveal the big theme. Themes bigger than TV, HBO, The New Yorker, bigger than big poetry, burning big as a Crunchwrap supreme. In this age, we've lost the bigness. In our biggest selves? No, no. We had a big deficit and big depression, a chunky little pandemic, and big poof. Big chungus overseeing the last big gasp of our time. Big chungus arrives. Big, big, big. Chungus, big inflate yourself. Big inflate our time. Christina traditionally has six words shifting around. You might guess my word that I just used again and again was big. this next poem, a little bit of a shift in tone, I guess, sort of inspired by another contemporary poet, Thuriya Almontazer, her book, Wild Fox of Yemen, highly recommend. I'm sure White Whale might have it, or be happy to order it for you, along with the great books from readers tonight. I guess her poem, Hunting Girlhood, deals a lot with describing or navigating feminism or being a woman in the world. And so I wanted to try to write a little bit about being a dude, I guess, which might not be the most interesting take, I get it, but I gave it a shot. So this poem's called A Plume. Manliness is a wood thrush. I left it swimming from my heart, wings smacking the air beside the arborvitae. My uncle crashes his motorbike and we laugh over a keg. Funny to be alive. I'm told to take and to take, to take, take, take. As my body breaks, it feels so good to fall. No longer hard, softening like a cemetery after the rain, like the body under an unmarked stone. Like that, a red-tailed hawk descends into the Monroeville Mall and builds a nest. After, I let it take my liver, haha. Knowing each day flaps deathward. And pleasure is the air that links me into feathers. Feathers say, you will shoot an arrow into flesh or be a wounded doe. A scrotal river winds, and somewhere a father hears this as quiet pleading. He tells his son, no one will give it to you. The son replies, that is a lie. You have given me everything. Rage begins to warm a room, and even when I stood alone, I had a big chest, a testicle that nearly glowed, and I never hid nothing, never got told who to be. No one tells me who to be, and anger is a cudgel. I blister beautiful calluses. I love sweating, cutting and deadheading, fixing, mending, moving, looking and finding and eating. I will tear the wax wings from my back, and I will fling myself to the sea. I am gathering the wood thrush. I have never held that speckled thing. My hands are tougher than feathers. Feathers are strong, but not tough. My sister gathers diaries. I gather rocks and snake skins like a bird building a nest so big it flies in the wind. I blaze like glory. I push harder to be what? Is this grace? No matter. I am filled with burning. I am in the stomach. I never wanted to fly as much as I wanted to be held. I am stronger than feathers, stronger than fire. Hold me, I call so caustically. All the men I wanted to be do not hesitate. They say, eat the bird. I take the wings. I swallow the bones. Check the time, which has immediately disappeared. Okay, I think I'm in okay shape. This poem is called The Robins. When I feel like a sick horse dragging the weight of a sinking empire beneath my ugly hooves. When I hear the cooper's hawk whinnying, when the squirrels move like shadows over bony roots with acorns stuffed between their jaws. When the dreary sun grows ravenous and the clover seeds begin raging inside their chests. I bellow, wing, eyelash, bitter wind, learning to flail by beaking into red clay, pulling rotten syllables from my tongue, like an earthworm, broken and dangling. When I hear the rock dove cooing, when I thought I knew anything about the sky. One more, either I didn't set my timer or I've been reading very fast, so I appreciate your attention. This was supposed to be like a 15 minute and we're like just over 10, so either doing a good job or you can hear about 30% of the words. Either way, we're in good shape. This last poem takes the form of a quatern, which is a form that has four stanzas, four lines in each, and a refrain that kind of travels down the poem, if you can imagine that. So the first line of the poem becomes the last line of the poem. It also owes a debt to my niece Macy, who might be watching remotely or might be password that. Sure. Who taught me you could blow on a dandelion seed and then say, holy smokes. And so that's going to happen in this moment. We can all look forward to that. And this is my last poem. I didn't say that. The weight. Which weight did I know? In which did I fail to carry? And what does one red cardinal weigh atop a wooden fence in front of the yellow siding? The weight of, please spare me, what a man might own, what he might lift overhead, hoist once. Before his bones grow hollow, his mind grows dense. Which weight did I know, and which did I fail to carry? I hummed the tune, my throat failed me, made little sense, then grew numb. How many times, how involuntary. Dandelions blossom, holy smokes. And then to seed. The root tastes bitter, but I will not wince at which weight I know in which I failed to carry. Beyond myself, and is everything besides myself. The flash of red is a signal to stop. The flesh hints, however, nature is softer, more reckless than it seems. But there is little time to know, so little. So little, so little, this weight that I know, this weight I fail to carry. Thank you all, you've been wonderful.
Thank you, Mike. That was wonderful. Thank you so much. Because we were thinking about this reading, I was really excited to learn that a poet and editor whom I'd heard about but had actually never met had moved to Pittsburgh. And that is Gwendolyn Mitchell, who will be reading here tonight. She is poet, and she moved back to Pittsburgh from Chicago, where she was the senior editor of Third World Press, which published Gwendolyn Brooks, Sonia Sanchez, among others, a very important press. And Gwendolyn's own poems have been published in journals such as American Review, Prairie Schooner, Poetry South, Essence Magazine. She has conducted workshops and seminars on poetry, the literary arts across the country, and she's the author of the poetry collection House of Women and the co-editor of two literary anthologies. She lives in Pittsburgh now, and she is a member of and a mentor for the Mad Women in the Attic community of writers. Please welcome Gwendolyn A. Mitchell.
Yeah. Hemingway Whale. I mean, I'm so excited to be here as part of the Hemingway reading series. And it's good to see folks in person. So I think, you know, this is good. So I just welcome each of you. And of course, I'm the one who doesn't know how to work the mic. to spend a few moments with us. "100 Things I Don't Want to Miss Each Day." Thank you, Halsey. We had to give special thanks to Halsey. "I will not miss a day to 1, pray, 2, say I love you, 3, touch something green, 4, listen with my whole self, 5, do something kind for someone, 6, learn something new, 7, know I am not defined by my mistakes, 8, tell a good story, 9, keep criticism to myself, 10, my list continues. Crying for the dead. I would cry for you, Randy Alexander, age 5. Kenya McPherson, 18 months. Valerie Christian, age 21. I would cry for the 28 nameless protesters who marched to their death in a Black South African homeland, and for the brown woman and her unborn baby girl who were part of a crowd that was sprayed with maddening gunshots and terror. I would cry for the 10 dead in Buffalo, New York, from actions labeled as a racially motivated crime. But who needs the foolish tears of a grown woman crying into a heap of already yesterday's news? My own dead might bring cause for tears, an expected grieving wail, loud and unencumbered. Let it out, child, let it out. Cleanse your sorrows in a river of tears. But for the everyday dead, there's no time for crying. Tomorrow the names will be replaced with a new list, the next day with yet another. And it will go on like that. It has always been like that. Is it wrong that words of comfort are brought and sold as a commodity in an untapped market? How else could those of us left living forgive ourselves for the unasked prayers, for the unspoken words of praise? We trade our silence for tears and hope to reclaim the world's loss. Vision. It's 2 glasses or not glasses, so. And I have glare. American Traveler's Guide to Negro Monuments. We always left in the middle of the night. Daddy would fold maps spread out on the dining room table, tuck them into the glove compartment and pack the car. We would pile in spaces designated with invisible barriers and old eiderdownish pillows. His goal, to be nearing Cincinnati for the first mid-morning stop. We never knew there was a method to our trip down south, a reason for what we anticipated, logic for what excited us beyond our desires to go. A full tank of gas, 2 thermoses, 1 hot for coffee, 1 cold for Kool-Aid, a packed picnic basket, boiled eggs and bacon strips for breakfast, sandwiches wrapped in wax paper, fried chicken secured in Mama's prized Tupperware, and fruit for the side of the road picnic table lunch stops. We travel gingerly and gaily on the outskirts of the perceived South, took carefully sustained and familiar roads. In the car, everything became a game. Be on the lookout for the Esso or Gulf or American Oil gas stations, our keen eyes peering over the fast moving terrain. Daddy slowed down for cows and horses, sped up to move over bridges. Was this the sign my parents looked for? A warn, as you ask us as you travel. Safe stop along the highway, not too far from main roads. Were they glad? We were too distracted to notice or too young to know the meanings of for whites only, or for colors, an arrow pointing around the corner where we held our breath, stood wide-legged in a stall, or squatted on the wooden bench above a cavernous hole of the outdoor roadside rest stop. Mama wipes our hands with her pre-soaked washcloths, ushers us back into the car. We must make the midpoint stop before dark.
You know, you don't have to be quiet or, you know, there's a lot out there, you know. Why? Yell, shout, scream, clap.
We love you.
Thank you. That's how fun you feel.
Among the missing, girl who shares my name is missing. The 17-year-old child of some mother in anguish of not knowing did not come home. And now her picture hangs on this wall with a dozen other pictures of missing. I hear voices speaking our name in the largeness of what we do not understand. They call out, daughter, where are you? Daughter. They are prepared to keep calling until you answer. I wake with worry, and our only connection is this name. Somehow thrown away on a snowdrift in the deep winter, frozen solid in the seasonally below cold nights. If you were my child, I'd check your room for drafts. Wrap an extra blanket over your body, just covering your head and the mass of hair on your pillow. I'd watch you readjust your body, then turn to do the same to your sister who already anticipates our ritual. If you were my child, how long ago would you have stopped playing hide and seek and catch me games? Would I have been the watchful-eyed mother on the bench at the edge of the playground, listening for the ollie ollie income free chant as the game ended, or was I never there? If you were my child, would I see signs of what pushed you away, or would my hold to a dream promise be illusion, blurring our vision of tomorrow will be different? When would I have noticed that you had already been taken to another place of shelter in this storm? Where do you look for missing and lost? This is not like the glasses that I retrace my steps through lived-in rooms and find carelessly placed next to today's mail. This is not like the keys or cell phone that are swallowed daily into the vast inside carry-on bag. You don't lose a whole person, do you? Daughter, can you hear us calling your name? Name in the prayer box on the altar For 22 weeks, a fresh piece of paper is placed in the box. We pray. We wait to find you among the missing. Bread baking. Bread baking was my way back into myself and out again. The steady knead, heel palm lift, and gentle thrust, flour dust on sleeves and usually in my hair. Sometimes I can almost feel my mother's eyes watching over my shoulder, her hands guiding my hands into the soft mound on the kitchen table. Mama taught all her children how to knead dough, and she would coat her fingers and pastry cloth with an even layer of white. Her hands moved with ease. The ritual had begun and ended with a second rising of oven-ready bread, a warmth worth the wait. Bread bakers are food givers. For a woman to share her food is to share her wealth, abuse her table, and you abuse her as well. Food is strength. It is power. It is history passed down like an heirloom treasure. It is lineage, a continuance passed on like a name. Learn to bake bread and you learn the lessons of patience, of persistence, and discipline. Learn to make bread and you know the elements needed for strong mind's growth, for nation building, and for love. Waiting for familiar. For a moment, I did not know the road. The dark had taken over when memory stopped, but I kept driving, waiting for familiar signs, bumps, bends, curves that would take me home. For a moment, the night and the rain had missed away safeness, all cognition. I thought I was lost. I thought this must be how she felt. That day, I found her in the middle of the street, her hat hiding uncombed hair. She wore her slip on the outside of a floral printed house dress, one stocking loosened from its knot below her knee was bunched at her ankle. She was on her way somewhere before she was stopped, lost among familiar signs. She looked at me without perception, as if I had the face of a stranger. She backed away like a frightened child. I took her hand. Grandmother, let's go home. Letting go. It's not supposed to be easy, this loosing of self, the choosing good and useful artifacts from among the clutter that defines your episodic existence. Act like no one is watching. Not even you, and let go. I needed that for myself. Let's go. I feel like the mic said when he's just breezing through this stuff. I timed and everything too. But,
no worries.
No worries. Then I'm gonna put this back in right here. Okay. If there are no worries. And I just want to thank everybody, you know, just for, you know, coming and sharing and, you know, just the richness of what's been shared this evening. I really have been fed, you know, very well. And I appreciate that my fellow readers tonight. Rock Talk. Rewriting a nameless woman's story. What do you tell a sister caught in the white light of judgment What do you say when she walks in your house for that morning cup of coffee and her story precedes her? The street and all its business in your face. Act as if you do not know and wait for her weighted release as she stirs cream into liquid, as she lifts the cup to face and allows the aroma to reach her nose before carefully taking those first sips. She readies herself and leans back into the chair at your kitchen table, her voice barely audible. You heard, didn't you? She looks you square in the face, her eyes a tear swell as you nod and speak your affirmation. The silence between you bridges so much that was loud and bold, deliberate defiance of what you knew was right. Places you've been told not to go, but end up anyway. You think to yourself, it could have been me. Would you be the sister safe space with heart words? I hear you talking, ignore crowd murmurings, grapevine truths, and push what happened girl curiosities aside. Today, when she comes for fresh baked muffins and coffee, looking for the woman she would have been on any other morning, satisfaction on her face, ready to share details of man talk between women, always open for debates on wrongs and rights. Will you recognize that now she is lost to that self? Will never go back on the promise she made. This time is different from the first, second, third chance resolutions. Broken as a yearly ritual, she speaks, her voice clear, her tone lucid. I didn't think it would be so simple. The struggle against struggle was my own doing and undoing. There he stood, like a loving father, giving instruction to a disobedient daughter. Go and sin no more. Released from a dream of horrors, he sent me home. You listen as she speaks, her words, your mouth, one prayer, a shared salvation.
That was nice. If I had been, you know, in the space where the woman caught in adultery in the Bible, you know, that's the day after. Here she's sitting with us. I don't throw things away, but perhaps one day I will. Maybe when we are gone, someone looking for fabric or pieces of quilt will find these unfinished poems. The words would have gathered the smell of things cherished, like the book of poems my father gave me that summer before I was grown, though close to 30 by some clock in distant meter. The pages had the flavor of cedar and polished leather that lingered on all of his things. Once, while shining his brass and boots, he stopped to show me both sides of an old coin given to him by his father's father. This has value, he said, and closed it back into his green army trunk with a 1950 annual, an unclasped strand of pearls, and his bits of fortune. Whenever I open the book and find his scent, I know why I have become the collector of words and music and stamps and corner treasures. So I started with a list of things that I want to do each day. And I'm going to end with my list of necessities. God, water, peace, brisk walks, pen and paper, green things to eat, you, time for solitude and reflection, music, healing words, the laughter of children, a warm
bed at night. Apples and apple pie. The comfort of your arms. Sensible shoes. A map of the world and a passport. God's will be done in my life. Books to read and enjoy. Family. Sunrises and surprises. The ability to forgive you. Thank you.
I want to thank you all for being here tonight. I know if Jimmy Svedek, the founder of the series, were here, he would say, you have honored poetry. This has been a wonderful evening of poetry. I want to take a moment to remember a Pittsburgh poet who passed away on April the 25th. Her name was Shirley Sue Stevens. She was someone I have known for about 30 years, because in a foolish misadventure, I was a counselor in the school in which she was the legendary English teacher at Quaker Valley. And she was a great editor and directed a literary magazine for many years and inspired people to write poetry, believe they could. And she, for those of you who are in a workshop, I'm sure some, one or two of you might have been in a workshop. She had this wonderful way of saying, would you consider? As opposed to, if this were my poem, I would. Sam Hazos spoke about her recently, actually for the obituary, and he said, she knew good poetry. She was a wonderful poet. And she knew good poetry. She was also the teacher you'd go to if you actually wanted, you know, when you really needed help with your writing. And many kids came back and thanked her for having inspired her and also for getting her ready for college. So I miss her a lot. We are going to be really, we have 6 more weeks of this series. Yes! And in 2 weeks, which will be May the 31st, we are really lucky to have another amazing lineup of poets who in fact, I'm sure have never, ever read together before, including Halsey Heyer. Okay. Alan Macho, Diana Coy Nguyen, Ellen McGrath-Smith, and Arlene Wiener, and they will be here in 2 weeks, and it will be a really interesting mix of voices. It'll be really exciting and great, and I hope you will all be here as well, if not in the Zoom world, in the real, here we are, among the books world. And I'd like to just mention that you can hear this reading again of the Hemingway's a poetry series blogspot, and it'll be up in a couple weeks or maybe even sooner, along with last week's and the last 12 years of poetry, the Hemingway Summer Poetry Series. So logging of it. See, what were they doing like 8 years ago? And who is Ed Ochester anyway? And in case that isn't clear to you, you can find out. Thank you, Y-Whale. Thank you, amazing poets. And thank you, our wonderful audience. Thanks for being here tonight. You take care.